Welcome to RISC Learning, a web seminar series offered by the Superfund Basic Research Program, NIEHS, in collaboration with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Today's session, Nanotechnology, Enamel Remediation, is the third in a 10-part series titled Nanotechnology, Applications and Implications for Superfund. Looking ahead, the next session on April 19th, Port of Use Nanotechnology for Superfund Site Remediation, featuring Marty Otto, EPA's Office of Superfund Mediation and Technology Innovation, as well as Mary Logan of EPA's Region 5 in Chicago. On May 31st, Ian Kennedy of UC Davis and Paul Gilman of Oak Ridge National Lab, will introduce nanotechnology-based sensors for the detection of environmental contaminants. And in the fall, the series will shift first to discuss some of the human and environmental implications of nanotech. These seminars will be announced in a direct letter and can be found on the SBRP and website. Before we begin, I'd like to thank the people from NIEHS, PA, and MPB Associates who organized this web seminar series, whose names are titled, and thank them to clue in. Since Superfund began back in 1980, much progress has been made in cleaning up sites. Many would agree that our toughest problems are the ones that remain, and part of that group are the sites with tough contamination. This is a bit of a challenge. Site characterization and remediation aspects of cleanup that are pretty tough to deal with. Simply put, this contamination is hard to find and difficult to clean up, but not impossible. Today's presentation should provide some tools to assist you with cleanup of enamel sites. Matthew Hull and Peter Bixlin will begin the seminar today. Investigator at Luna Innovations Incorporated, where he develops technologies and strategies to protect and environmental health. Peter is an assistant professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Virginia Tech, studies the interstitial environmental chemistry of natural and engineered systems. Matt and Peter will speak about their collaborative research as part of their EPA SBIR grant, that Small Business Innovative Research. The title of their talk is Magnetite Nanoparticles for Remediation of Contaminated Groundwater. Welcome, Matt and Peter.
Thank you, Michael. This is Matt Hall. As Mike indicated, I'm going to be talking about magnetite nanoparticles for remediation of contaminated groundwater. I'm joined by my collaborator on this project, Dr. Peter Bickeslin of Virginia Tech. Quickly, the EPA SBIR grant here is an award made to Luna Innovations, which is a company headquartered in Blacksburg, Virginia, that specializes in developing and commercializing molecular technology and sensing solutions. And the work that I'm about to describe to you is supported under this particular EPA SBIR grant. And we are subcontracting a portion of that work to Dr. Bickeslin, whose technology is extremely valuable in this application. I will quickly move through the talk. So moving on to slide number 3, I'm just going to provide here a quick overview of how the talk here that Peter and I will be delivering is to proceed. I want to talk quickly about the EPA SBIR program. Some folks might not be familiar with it. The objectives of that program may be a little bit different from some of the basic research that some of you may be familiar with, and I think it's important to clarify that. I'll turn the talk over to Peter to describe some of the details on magnetite characterization and reactivity. He'll pass the talk back to me to describe some of the work that Luna is doing on this program, in addition to our assistance with commercializing and scaling up the technology, some of the encapsulation work that we're doing to help facilitate the delivery of nanoparticles subsurface environment, as well as to enhance their overall applicability in environmental and biological applications. I'll offer a few thoughts on nanotechnology, environmental health and safety, which most folks who are on this call and on the internet are probably familiar with some of the issues that have been raised recently regarding this subject. And it's certainly important for us to consider those early on in the development of the technology, so we'll comment briefly on that. And then wrap up our first portion of the talk with some general conclusion and turn things over to Greg Clower. So moving on to slide number 4, quick overview of the EPA SBIR program. The goal of the EPA SBIR program is to research, develop, and commercialize high-risk, high-payoff technologies that help solve environmental challenges. The program consists of 3 phases, starting in phase 1, where technology developers are to demonstrate the technical feasibility of the ideas that they have set forth. We have moved through phase 1 and are currently in the first year of a phase 2 contract where we're optimizing the technology and scaling it up such that it can be offered to end users for sale and for commercial applications. In phase 3, the product is in its final commercialization stages and is made available to users via our common commercial avenue. Moving on to slide 5, to provide just a little bit more detail about what the specific EPA SBIR program, what the goals of this program were. The first is to develop the magnetite nanoparticles that Peter will be talking more about here shortly, typically for the remediation of chlorinated organic compounds and other targets. The second component is to develop delivery strategies that facilitate particle delivery and application in the environment and to help enhance interaction of these particles with targets. And then the third thing is to scale up production of a phase-optimized nanoparticle commercial environmental remediation application. So moving on to slide number 6, I will turn the talk over to Dr. Peter Vickersland, who will describe in more detail some of the magnetite characterization and reactivity work underway in this SBIR program. Peter?
This is Dr. Peter Vickersland of the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Virginia Tech. And today I'll be talking about experiments that we've been conducting to examine the activity of nanoparticles for carbonic chloride. And in particular, I'll be discussing the particle size and the aggregation state of these particles affect are their measured reactivity. So moving on to slide 7.
Could you speak up, please?
Hi, let me remind those of you connecting. Excuse me for a minute, Matt. I'm sorry. Let me remind those of you connecting by phone. We're having an issue with the sound today. We're not sure what it is. We do realize there is a bad echo. It seems worse. It seems worse on my audio, so I'm staying on mute. Let me remind the rest of the participants: please keep your phones on mute unless you're speaking. This will help us to reduce the background noise, and hopefully we'll be able to deal with the echo. Thank you.
All right, so we're slide 7. Hopefully everybody can hear me now. Basically, our interest in the whole topic of nanoparticulate magnetite developed out of some previous work that we had done looking at the activity of zirconium iron thermoreactive barrier. And as many of you probably know, iron-based thermoreactive barriers been shown to be a very effective method.
Peter, let me interrupt you again for just one second. I'm very sorry. We're getting your audio is very low. See if we can get you to speak up a bit. And if I break in again, we may ask you to pick up the handset and see if that helps. But try just a bit louder voice, maybe a bit closer to the conference phone. Thank you.
Is this better?
That sounds a bit better. Thank you.
Okay, I picked up the handset now. Basically, as many of you know, as the iron within these barriers reacts with groundwater contaminants or actually with the groundwater itself, the iron gets converted from the zero valent oxidation state to ferrous iron, or Fe2, and ultimately to ferric iron, or Fe3. And basically, as this process occurs, you develop a whole series of nanoscale corrosion products on the surface of the iron particles. And of these nanoscale
rodent products. One of them happens to be nanosecond, and that's actually how we got interested in the whole concept of nanoscale magnetite particles. And we're initially primarily interested in what role they would actually play in dictating the reactivity of these permeable reactive barriers. So moving to slide 8. In addition to the fact that you see nanoscale corrosion products developing in these permeable barriers, we also find magnetite as present as a surface rim on the RNA particles that Dr. Lowry is going to be talking about in a few minutes. Magnetite nanoparticles are produced intracellularly within magnetotechnic bacteria. They're also produced extracellularly due to the action of metal-reducing bacteria. That's been well established. There's also a lot of interest in the use of magnetite nanoparticles and similar nanoparticles for magnetic resonance contrast agents and things like that. So there's a great deal of interest trying to examine and understand magnetite nanoparticle reactivity. So moving on to slide 9. The magnetite that we have primarily used in our studies is basically developed through core precipitation method, where we basically use an established literature procedure where we take a mixture of ferrous chloride and ferric chloride and add that to sodium hydroxide at high pH, rapidly stir this, and basically by precisely controlling our reaction conditions, we can get a very monodisperse suspension. There's a TEM figure here illustrating where we get mean particle diameter of around 9.2 nanometers very reproducibly. And all of these syntheses are always done under conditions of strict oxygen exclusion, basically. We want to make sure that we keep things as anaerobic as possible so that we can maximize our reactivity. And the isoelectric point for our particle suspensions is about 6.5. And I'll explain why that's important in a few minutes. Moving on to slide 10. I've explained a little bit about why we're interested in magnetite, and I want to talk a little bit about why we care about carbon tetrachloride. As many of you also probably know, carbon tetrachloride is a ubiquitous groundwater contaminant, basically because it's got lots of uses as cleaning fluids or pesticides and so on. Carbon tetrachloride is ubiquitous groundwater contaminant due to all of these uses. It's a suspected carcinogen and has a EPA limit in drinking water of 5 parts per billion. One of the problems with carbon tetrachloride is that most of the remediation schemes to treat carbon tetrachloride basically convert it from CCl4 into products like chloroform, CHCl3, as well as dichloromethane, or CHCl2, both of which have toxicity issues associated with them. So you're basically converting from a carbon tetrachloride problem to a chloroform or a dichloromethane problem. So you really haven't fixed the situation just by doing that transfer. So moving on to slide 11, it's a little bit of background, and now we're going to get into some of our own actual experimental results. Basically, what we initially looked at in one of our first interests was to try and see how magnetite reactivity varied as a function of particle size. And so I'm going to go through this slide fairly slowly because there's a lot of information on here. But basically, we compared the reactivity of bulk magnetite. These are large magnetite particles, average diameter of about 80 nanometers, to what we'll refer to hereafter as nanomagnetite, with particles of 9 nanometer diameter. And basically, the data that's shown in black is with the bulk magnetite. And we see that we have a fairly slow or low level of reactivity with this material relative to what we see with the nanomagnetite, the data that's shown in red. And we see that there's this distinct difference in the rate at which carbon tetrachloride disappears. And our first look at this result, basically, we were wondering whether it's just due to the fact that we have a much greater surface area available in the nanoparticulate suspension. But even after we normalize our reaction rates by either the VET surface area, so that's a surface area determined from geometric considerations of our particle size, or TEM-based surface areas, we still see that there's a significant difference in our rate constants, telling us that there's a big difference between nanoparticular magnetite versus bulk magnetite. So moving on to slide 12. After we had obtained these very promising results in the lab, we wanted to actually see whether commercially available magnetites might also exhibit the same effects. And so we did an experiment where we looked at three different commercially available magnetite products, varied the magnetite loading between 1 and 3 grams per liter. But unfortunately, with these commercial products, we didn't see that there was any reactivity whatsoever. And we attribute this difference to the fact that these products are exposed to oxygen, whereas all of our materials were completely done in the exclusion of oxygen, and that significantly affects some of the surface reactivity. So moving on to slide 13. Going back to our experiments with our magnetite that we produced in the lab, we expanded our suite of conditions that we were examining and looked at the effect of pH on the measured reactivity. And basically what we're looking at here are mass normalized reaction rates. So this is a first order reaction rate basically divided by the mass of magnetite that we have added to the suspension, and that's compared as a function of pH. And what we have in the data at the top of this figure is data that was collected with nanoparticulate magnetite, and the data that is the open symbols is data collected with bulk magnetite, either in our lab or data that was published previously in the literature by Danielson and Hayes. And basically, we see that there's a big difference between the measured rate constants for our nanoparticulate magnetite versus those with the bulk magnetite. Basically, a 1 to 2 order of magnitude difference in our measured rate constants, clearly telling us that there's something intrinsically more reactive about our nanoparticulate magnetite than the bulk magnetite. We also see, if we look just at the data that we collected with nanoparticulate magnetite, that the data that's shown in black was experiments that were done at a low ionic strength of 0.001 molar sodium chloride. Data that's in red was conducted at a higher ionic strength, and we see that consistently the higher ionic strength experiments had a lower level of reactivity. So not only is there a size effect that affects what's going on, but there's also effects in terms of the electrolyte composition. One thing I want to point out before we move on to the next slide is that the mass normalized rate constants that we have here for carbon tetrachloride degradation with our magnetite, or with our nanomagnetite, I should say, are actually very comparable to those reported in the literature for nanoscale zero-valent iron reacting with carbon tetrachloride, and those are results from Nurmi et al. In 2005. So moving on to slide 14. The previous slide, we had normalized everything just simply by the mass. We also wanted to just double-check and normalize things by the surface area. So in this case, we normalized either by the VET, so basically got surface area from the VET, or we did surface areas determined from geometric considerations and examination of our TEM micrographs. And again, we still see that there's a big difference between the bulk results and those that we obtain with our nanoparticulate magnetite. And we don't really 100% know exactly what is causing this big difference, but it's clearly that it's happening. Some of it might be things like quantum confinement and other kinds of nanoparticular or nanoscale size effects that people talk about a lot in the literature these days. But some of it also could be due to the fact that as we get smaller and smaller magnetite particles, we decrease the diffusion path length for ferrous iron and for electron transfer within these particles. But I'll talk a little bit more about that near the end of my presentation. Moving on to slide 15. I mentioned before that we see that there are differences in reactivity as a function of ionic strength. And we wanted to examine those differences a little bit more carefully, so we expanded the range of ionic strength that we tested. And the data that's shown in the leftmost panel basically is a mass normalized rate constant as a function of ionic strength at pH 7 with 5 grams per liter of magnetite. And we see that as we go from really low ionic strength, 0.001 molar to 1 molar, that there's actually a 42% decline in the measured rate constant. So clearly there's a difference as we increase our ionic strength. We attribute this difference to the fact that at higher ionic strengths, we actually have much higher stable aggregate sizes in our suspensions. That's actually what's shown in the right panel here, where we have dynamic light scattering data, where we looked at aggregate size as a function of ionic strength. And at low ionic strength, where we had the highest levels of reactivity, we have a stable aggregate size of around 450 nanometers. As we go to higher ionic strengths, upwards like 0.1 molar, 1 molar, we see that the stable aggregate size gets to be somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000, which is actually approaching the detection limits for our dynamic light scattering instrument. So clearly there is a much higher or a much larger stable aggregate size at higher ionic strengths. Moving on to slide 16, the data that's in the leftmost panel is what I've actually just shown for pH 7. I mentioned before that the isoelectric point for our magnetite suspensions was at pH 6.5. One of the well-known things in colloid suspensions is that the closer you are to the isoelectric point, the lesser the effect of changes in ionic strength are on the aggregation of those suspensions. So what we wanted to do is to go to a higher pH and be further away from that isoelectric point and see what would happen. And basically, as we get further away from the isoelectric point, up to pH 7.8, in the right panel, our reactivity difference increases from just being a 42% decline in reactivity to something more like an 80% decline in reactivity over that same ionic strength range. So not only do we see that ionic strength affects things, but pH also plays a role in dictating our measured reactivity. We can explain all of this, as shown in figure 17, basically using standard colloid stability, DLVO theory, and things like that. Basically, at low ionic strengths, as the particles approach one another, their electric double layers are going to overlap, and that's going to cause the particles to repel. As you get to higher ionic strengths, in contrast, that double layer shrinks, and the particles are allowed to come closer together, which allows them to aggregate, and eventually they have the ability to aggregate enough that they start to settle out, and that's actually what's shown in the images of bottles that were allowed to settle for 1 hour, both at low ionic strength and kind of at a medium ionic strength. So moving on to slide 18. In addition to looking at the effects of ionic strength with sodium chloride, which is the data that I've shown thus far, we also looked at a couple of other different electrolytes. Sodium perchlorate, which is also a monovalent electrolyte, compare that to our sodium chloride results, and we basically see that we actually observe a slightly higher rate with sodium perchlorate than with sodium chloride, and we attribute some of that to the fact that in the sodium chloride suspensions, we have one of the products of our dechlorination process that's present in suspension that's going to affect some of our measured reactivity. We can also compare our sodium chloride results with those with calcium chloride, and we basically see that at low ionic strengths, the effects of calcium chloride are much greater, and we can basically explain that also with standard colloid theory, and basically the Schultz-Hardy rule tells us that divalent cations like calcium are going to have a much greater effect in terms of particle aggregation at a given ionic strength than monovalent cations like sodium chloride. So moving on to slide 19, I want to talk a little bit about the different products that we produce in these reactions. I'm just going to focus on the leftmost portion of this diagram. And basically, carbon tetrachloride is what we start with at the top, and it undergoes a series of different electron transfers. And we can produce things like chloroform, that's the circled compound in the middle of the diagram. And then we can also produce things like formate as well as carbon monoxide. And ideally, we're going to produce formate and carbon monoxide in greater percentages than we are going to produce chloroform. And so we want to see what we get in our different suspensions as a function of pH and ionic strength and so on. And I'm going to present those results here in slide 20.
And Peter, let me interrupt you for just a minute. This is Larry Witson. I'm sorry. Could we get you just to speak up just a little bit? Actually, the echo seems quite a bit better for your audio, not for mine. But if we could get you to speak up just a little bit, it might help a little bit more. Thank you.
All right. Basically, what this slide presents is chloroform yields as a function of pH as well as a function of ionic strength. And what we are looking at is as this ratio, which is the chloroform concentration that we measured at the end of a reaction to the initial carbon tetrachloride concentration, as that increases, you're producing more chloroform, which is obviously undesired. And what we see is that at low pH values, we have a greater percentage of products other than chloroform, and as we get to higher pH, we start to produce more and more chloroform. Interestingly, one of the things that we see also is that as we decrease our ionic strength, and that's the data that's been circled, we see that there is a increase in the chloroform yield at higher ionic strengths, which is interesting given the fact that we had faster reactivity at higher ionic strengths, and we're currently trying to understand exactly why we get these much higher chloroform yields at low ionic strengths. Moving on to slide 21, one of the interesting things, well, another interesting thing that happens in these suspensions is that we believe that the aggregates that exist in these suspensions actually change their shape during the course of the oxidation process. As magnetite is oxidized, so we take a black magnetite particle, it gets oxidized to produce magnemite, or Fe2O3. During this oxidation process, we might expect that the aggregates that we have in these suspensions, they might not undergo any changes, or they actually might kind of fall apart and then form different types of aggregates. The implications of this restructuring process on our measured reactivity are currently unknown, but it's something that we're actively trying to understand. Moving on to slide 22, which basically kind of talks through this in a little bit more detail, one of the things that happens in these particular suspensions is that magnetite, as it oxidizes, eventually to magnemite, which is the brown dots from the black dots, basically you end up producing a magnemite rim around the outside of our magnetite particle. In order for electron neutrality to be maintained in these particles, Fe2 actually has to diffuse to the surface of these particles during the oxidation process. And as that diffusion process occurs, you can have some of these different types of restructuring processes that we think are happening that affect our measured reactivity. So moving on to slide 23, this is basically the last thing before we turn this all back over to Matt and he can wrap up our portion of the presentation. Want to talk a little bit about how we think magnetite and carbon tetrachloride are reacting and what the implications are in terms of our measured reaction rates. Basically, magnetite reacts with carbon tetrachloride to produce magnemite, ferrous iron, and at least as written here, chloroform. There are many different things that could actually affect the kinetics of this process. The first of these I just briefly touched on is actually this diffusion of ferrous iron from the core of these particles out to the outside. So basically we have these core shell particles where we have a magnetite core, which is our reactive phase, that's surrounded by an inactive magnemite phase. So that could have possible rate modifying effects. We also are going to have diffusion of carbon tetrachloride onto the surface of our magnetite, and that's going to be occurring both within our aggregate as well as on the surface of our aggregate. So that's going to have an effect on our measured reaction rate. And then the last thing is what most people have always historically focused on is the kinetics of the overall electron transfer process. And we actually think that all three of these play some role in the measured reactivity. And basically we're now in the process of trying to understand the relative magnitudes of these three separate processes. So with that, I'm going to turn this back over to Matt, and he'll talk a little bit about Luna's work with this project.
Thank you, Peter. Hopefully everyone is now on slide 24. As Peter just wrapped up mentioning some thoughts on reactivity of magnetite nanoparticles with carbon tetrachloride, I'm going to kind of finish up here with a couple remaining sections. So once we've prepared a reactive particle, this is really only half the battle. The next step is to develop a strategy to help deliver that particle to the environment, or to put it in a form that is that facilitates application, either in subsurface applications or in other environmental remediation applications. Under the Phase 2 program, we at LUNA, we're looking at a number of different strategies to stabilize the particles in suspension and accomplish this goal of facilitating their application in the environment. One of the techniques that we're looking at currently is an encapsulation method, and I'll that's what I'm going to talk about today. So moving on to slide number 25, just to illustrate this concept, folks might be wondering why a Trojan horse has ended up in a talk about nanoparticle remediation, but this really does illustrate the concept of what we're getting at here. The idea is to help protect the particles as synthesized in the laboratory to help maintain their reactive properties to the point of application so that they may more readily react with targets of interest. And particularly for our particles, and Peter mentioned the fact that we must maintain this anaerobic environment to help preserve the form of the iron. The Trojan horses help to serve, or these encapsulated particles help to preserve the redox state of the encapsulated particles. Now, this work has been examined before. The key example of this coming from Quinn et al. And a publication in Environmental Science and Technology in 2005. And some work that's been done at NASA. They looked at the use of encapsulated zero-valent iron for microvessels for addition of rate-enhancing reactants and remediation cocktails, and found that the encapsulated iron particles were quite useful for some of their applications. I'll talk a little bit more about the work by Quinn et al. In just a second, but in general, what I wanted to illustrate here was this concept of encapsulating the particles to afford an added layer of engineering control over the reaction chemistry and timing, and to help facilitate the application of these reactive particles in the environment. So moving on to slide 26, this is the work that I mentioned by Quinn et al., where they were looking at zero-valent iron encapsulated in an oil liquid, in a droplet consisting of an oil liquid membrane surrounding particles of zero-valent iron dispersed in water. They examined the reactivity of these particles with trichloroethene and found that it was unclear whether the particles were reactive. However, it was unclear whether the reactivity of the particles with trichloroethylene was due to zero-valent iron or to microbial enhancement from some of the oil that was incorporated with the particles. And it was also found that injection methods or some of these methods of environmental application can damage the droplets and thereby compromise some of the advantages that might be afforded due to the encapsulation process. So moving on to slide 27, we come to just a summary slide of the process that we've undertaken here at LUNA. This is a proprietary process, so I cannot offer a significant amount of detail in this regard. It differs from the process taken by Quinn et al., but what we're producing here, if you look at the lower left-hand corner of slide 27, you see an example of some of the magnetite-filled capsules that we've developed. As you look at the middle of the slide, you see an SEM image of one of our capsules. They vary in size, but generally they're centered around approximately 30 microns. And then as you move to the top right of that slide, you see what I've focused in on here is a protective gelatin layer that we've been able to form at the surface of those particles. And what that's designed to do is to help make the particles a little more robust when they're applied in the environment. To date, we've demonstrated the encapsulation process with both nano and microscale particles, with both particles synthesized in Peter's laboratory at Virginia Tech, as well as particles synthesized at LUNA, and those obtained from commercial suppliers. So moving on to slide 28, this just shows a expanded view of a batch of these encapsulated magnetite particles. And in the spirit of the SBIR program, I am inclined here to to invite others or to inform others that, that we are certainly interested in partnering with other folks to investigate the reactivity of these particles for environmental applications. We're also interested in forming partnerships with folks that may be interested in becoming beta test partners, assisting with product development and other aspects of the program. So moving on to slide 29, we do have a number of what I call here burning questions that we have to continue working out, and these will become the focus of the remaining year of the program. This will be to really focus on the reactivity of these encapsulated magnetite nanoparticles. Some of this work is currently underway in Peter's lab at Virginia Tech. We're looking at different strategies for controlling the and tuning these capsule particle composites. There's a number of opportunities here to leverage some of the existing work done by Quinn et al. And others to see how we can create these mixtures of components that really address the contaminant breakdown process from start to finish. And then we're also doing some studies and planning to do some studies to look at how we can tune the breakdown of the of that gelatin layer and so that we have more precise control over when reactions occur and to what extent they occur. Moving on to slide 30, I want to offer here a few thoughts about nanotechnology, environmental health, and safety. I think we can all agree that there's a number of significant societal benefits that can be realized from the responsible development of nanotechnology. We've demonstrated here and through Peter's work and through our collaboration here at Luna that we have an application here for nanotechnology to help remediate some of the most pressing environmental contaminants of our time. Greg will do the same in his talk to come shortly. But we must agree that there's also some possible unintended effects that we must be aware of and address early on in the development of this technology. From our perspective here at Luna, we've developed what's called our NanoSafe program, which we started in 2003 as a framework to help us address these environmental health and safety concerns proactively. And as a part of our work here with IRON, we are planning to begin third-party ecotoxicological testing of some of our various nano iron and encapsulated iron species to determine the feasibility of actually applying them in the real world environment. So moving on to slide 31, I'll offer a few conclusions here on the presentation. I'll also include a few conclusions from Peter's segment of the presentation. What we found is that magnetite prepared under strict anaerobic conditions can degrade carbon tetrachloride without the addition of ferrous iron. And on a mass basis, carbon tetrachloride loss rates appear to be enhanced in the presence of nanoparticulate magnetite. Chloroform yields are affected by both the solution pH and ionic strength. The encapsulation methods that we are currently developing at Luna and integrating with the magnetite technology may be useful for helping us tailor pH conditions so that we push that reaction towards a more favorable outcome, in other words, producing less chloroform. Surface normalization of the reactivity of nanoparticle suspensions may not be an accurate measure of presenting these data. Due to the fact that surface area is often determined for dried particulates as opposed to wet particles or as they occur in suspension. And Peter touched on a couple of those issues during his segment of the talk. Encapsulation may offer additional engineering control over interaction of particles with remediation targets and help facilitate their application in the environment. And we must continue to determine environmental health and safety issues with nanoiron, since this is an application that releases these particles or that would ultimately release these particles into the environment. We must continue to address those issues as a group of stakeholders. So moving on to slide 32, I'd like to acknowledge the folks who made this work possible, particularly the US EPA SBIR program, Mitch Lasad and Nora Savage. They are currently the US EPA program, as we've talked about throughout, is funding this collaboration and the bulk of this work. The National Science Foundation is also funding some of Dr. Vickislund's additional work regarding nanoscale magnetite. We'd like to also acknowledge folks at Virginia Tech and at Loon Innovations who have assisted with the experiments and analytical work described in this program. So with that, I'll offer up my contact information for anyone who, moving to slide 33, for anyone who has any additional questions, I can relay those to Peter, or if they are addressed to me, I can certainly answer those, and we'll be happy to address any questions now. Thank you.
Thank you, Matt. Okay, I've got the handset now. Hopefully we'll be keeping the echoes to a minimum. As we move to the question and answer period, I'd like to remind the phone participants, you can keep your phone on mute. When you're ready to ask a question, you can take your phone off mute and ask a question. For those of you connected on the internet, you can submit your questions at any time using the form that you get by pressing the question mark button that you'll see at the top of every slide. With that, let's check with our phone participants. If I could ask you to please, if you have a question, please go ahead and take your phone off mute. Please introduce yourself and name your organization and ask your question.
Hello. This is Chen Min Su from US EPA in Ada, Oklahoma. I have a question for slide number 11.
Go right ahead.
Yes, my question is, where is the 80 nanometer magnetite from? Is it synthetic magnetite or is it commercial magnetite?
The 80 nanometer magnetite is synthetic that we made in the lab, also under conditions of strict oxygen exclusion.
How did you control the size of these two magnetites?
The 80 nanometer magnetite is much, much more heterodispersed with small particle sizes, big particle sizes, but overall kind of an average of about 80 nanometer. The 9 nanometer, basically by the synthesis method and by precisely controlling how fast we add our ferrous and ferric chloride to the base solution, we can really control that particle size very easily.
So the slower the addition of the ferrous chloride, the smaller the magnetite particles you will get?
It's not quite that simple because you have to also adjust drop size and things like that. So it's not a completely straightforward process to try and optimize that actual particle size. But we've been able to reproduce these 9 nanometer particles probably hundreds of times now.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to read the question from one of our internet participants. This is from Kanapun Fenrat. Please excuse me if I got your name wrong. He's at Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh. What is the advantage of magnetite nanoparticles over zero valent iron nanoparticles?
Well, basically that's a interesting question, and that's one that we struggle with many times. Basically, our kind of approach here is to say that we presume, and we have not done the detailed cost calculations, that the magnetite nanoparticles are going to be cheaper on a cost basis than zero valent iron particles. And at least with respect to carbon tetrachloride, we see that we can get similar, at least mass normalized rate constants, and by extension, surface area normalized rate constants for the nanoscale magnetite versus the nanoparticulate, or the nanoscale zero valent iron. So at least for carbon tetrachloride, on a cost basis, it would suggest the magnetite is going to be better. We don't necessarily know how that extends to other contaminants, and that's something that we're currently trying to
get a better handle on.
And to add a little additional information to that, this is Matt. The reason for the two-pronged approach to our work is the basis of the SBIR is not simply on the fact that, we can make magnetite better than zero-valent iron. I don't think that's necessarily our objective. The concept was, based on the fact that this is an innovative technology that could be potentially lower cost, easier to scale up in production. But the other aspect that we are particularly interested in at Luna is developing a carrier that can take anyone's nanoparticles to the environment to which they are desired. So we've taken this two-pronged approach to develop an integrated solution to the problem. So if it ends up being that zero-valent iron can be made cheaply and effective, then we would be just as happy incorporating that or encapsulating that into some of our capsules and delivering it to subsurface environments as well. So hopefully that clears that up.
Okay, let's check back with our phone participants. If anyone has a question, please take your phone off mute and please introduce yourself and name your organization.
My name is Mary Logan. I'm with EPA in Region 5. I have a question about the conclusions with pH and ionic strength.
Okay.
Do you, in terms of the test that you're doing, are you working within a range that is reasonable that for what environmental conditions might be if this were to be moved into a field treatment? So, for example, out of the ionic strength you're working with, the ionic strength and the pH is similar to what we might encounter in groundwater?
The lower ends of the ionic strength range, so the 0.001 to 0.01 molar ionic strength is reasonable for many groundwater situations. And we basically tested a pH range from 6 up to about 8.5, so it should cover most environmental situations that we've at least seen in the literature.
Thank you.
Okay, let me read one from one of our internet participants. This is from Seth Bibley, U.S. EPA U.S. EPA in Chicago. Have you or do you plan to submit a pre-manufacturing notice under TSCA for this nano compound?
Once we get to the point where we're commercializing this, we would have to do that. And that I envision occurring in later part of year two. So currently that process has not been started, but we would absolutely seek to move that along through the appropriate channels and address the regulatory concerns regarding these products.
Thank you. Let's check back to the phone participants. If you have a question, please take your phone off mute and introduce yourself and name your organization.
Hello, this is Dan Briller with Booz Allen Hamilton in Chicago. Hello?
Hello.
Hello.
Yes. My question is, I noticed the characterization of the transformation pathways from carbon tetrachloride to chloroform. I'm curious as to whether you've studied the transformation potential for A, chlorobenzenes, and B, methylene chloride.
No, at this point, we've basically just primarily focused on carbon tetrachloride. There's enough interesting questions with carbon tetrachloride, trying to understand its reactivity, that it's been pretty much taking up all of our activities in this area. But maybe at some point, once we're further along in understanding this particular system, we'll move to some of those other ones.
Thanks. Let's stay with the phone participants. If anyone else has a question,
take your phone off mute and introduce yourself and name your organization. Okay, let me read another one from an internet participant. This is from Patrice Copeland, Santa Ana Regional Water Quality Control Board in Riverside, California. Patrice has two questions. One refers to slide 25. Can nanoparticles break through their encapsulation? The second question refers to slide 27. How thick is the protective layer on an encapsulated nanoparticle?
Those are good questions. In regards to the first one, it is not likely that the nanoparticles that we are synthesizing would break through that layer. The pore sizes are too small, and I don't know the exact sizes of the pores on those on the pores of that layer at this moment. So that is unlikely that they would pass through there. One of the other, just to kind of address another question that some folks on the phone might have, is whether or not even oxygen could diffuse through that layer. And certainly oxygen could potentially pass through that layer and oxidize the particles, but we're hoping that that this method will help slow that process down. So do we know all of the answers to what can pass through and or pass out of and into these particles? Absolutely not yet. And we are developing a series of assays to help investigate both the movement of oxygen through that membrane, as well as the movement of particles, as well as the effects of various physical, chemical, and biological processes on the degradation of that layer. Also, with regards to the thickness, it varies, and I can provide more specifics on the thickness of that layer to the individual via direct email. I cannot comment on that directly at this time.
Okay, I'd like to read another question from one of our international participants. This is from Ravindra Joshi with the Samaya Institute of Management in Mumbai, India. Ravindra asks, how long until this technology will be commercialized? A very rough and broad estimate is what I'm looking for.
Well, we're certainly targeting for to have commercial partners in place and some additional or some initial clients lined up by the end of the phase two within 1 year. We have quite a bit of work before us before we can reach that level. So I won't offer the fact that this is something that will be ready tomorrow. We've got a lot of work before us, and we want to make sure that what we put out there is a good product that does what we say it can do, and we don't want to jeopardize anything by rushing it to market. So I'm targeting within a year or possibly a year and a half. We'll see how it goes.
Thanks. I'd like to note that we're nearing the end of the question and answer period. Those of you who are connected on the phone, I'm going to give you a couple more chances. If anyone has a question, please be ready. Let me read one more from an internet participant. Excuse me. This is from Joshua Kadrumis, Black and Veatch in Kansas City, Missouri. Joshua asks, are the safety issues being evaluated associated with the unreacted particles or the oxidized Fe3 positive? I would think that the Fe3 positive would precipitate in the subsurface.
That's a great question, and I would say that what we're planning to do is both. We would like, if there's chemical reactivity here that varies between a unoxidized or a highly reduced particle and then versus a highly oxidized particle, if there's differences in how reactive those materials are chemically, then I would certainly think that there are differences in how they might behave biologically. So we are very interested in laying out, and we have, in fact, I've recently participated in designing studies that help address that very issue. It's expected that the different forms of the particles might partition into different compartments of the environment, water columns versus adsorb to soils or colloids, those types of things. So we certainly want to look at the full breadth of their fate and transport in the environment.
Let's check back with the phone participants. If you have a question, please take your phone off mute and introduce yourself and name your organization. Okay, I've got another one here from an internet participant. This is from Rob Ellis with Arcadis in Novi, Michigan. Rob asks, what is the potential for injectability of a 30 micromolar or approximately 30,000 nanomolar Fe304 encapsulation into a porous media?
There may be applications here where just taking a shot at that question. I assume that as opposed to micromolar, you're talking about micrometer. So you're talking about the size effects of injecting something into the ground that is not small enough to move through the environment appropriately. And what I mentioned as I made the transition from Peter's talk on the reactivity of the magnetite is that we are looking at various stabilization formulations. So we're looking at some things that don't involve encapsulating the particles at all. They just look at encapsulating the free particles, not encapsulating, but stabilizing the particles in suspension without the presence of a micron-sized carrier. So we are looking at both aspects that would facilitate injection of small nanoscale free particles in the environment, along with perhaps some more applications geared towards things like permeable reactive barriers using the larger micron size or encapsulated materials.
Thank you. Let me read a final question from one of our internet participants today, and we'll get ready to move on with the second presentation. Let me remind quickly those of you who are submitting questions over the internet. If I did not get a chance to read your question out, we may have a chance at the end, and I will come back to them. If not, I will forward the questions on to today's speakers, and hopefully we'll get answers by email. So please continue to submit the questions, and we'll try and get through as many of them as we can. Final question for this first question and answer period, submitted by Dustin Armstrong with Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection in Norristown, Pennsylvania. Dustin asks, have any field trials been performed for the nanoscale magnetite?
No, they have not. There are plans through the SBIR program to investigate a field validation at the end of the program, but we want to make sure that we have an optimized particle, be it a free particle, be it an encapsulated particle. We want to make sure that we have our best possible configuration of the particle here prior to doing any field trials. And we also want to make sure that we have a good handle on the EHS issues before we do that.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank both of you guys for your presentations today and also for your answers to the questions from our audience. I have roughly half a dozen additional questions, and we will save these for the end, or I will get them to you by email. With that, let's move on to today's second speaker. I'd like to bring Mike Gill back in briefly for an introduction for Greg Lowry. Mike?
Thanks again, Larry. Our second speaker today is Dr. Greg Lowry. Greg is an associate professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. Greg's research group investigates mobility and fate of nanomaterials in the environment in order to promote the sustainable development and use of nanomaterials. Greg's talk today is Functionalized Reactive Nanoscale Zero-Valent Iron or In-Situ DNAPL Remediation, Opportunities and Challenges. Thank you for presenting, Greg.
Greg, do we have you? Okay, I don't hear Greg. Mike, let me step out for just a minute, and I'm going to call him in an alternate number and see if we can connect. Folks in the audience, please bear with us for just a moment, and we'll see if we can get Greg.
While we're waiting, I can repeat what's coming up in this series. This is the third of a 10-part series on nanotech applications and implications for Superfund. On April 19th, the next session is going to be on the use of nanotechnology for Superfund site remediation, featuring Marty Otto of EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation and Mary Logan from EPA's Region 5 in Chicago. And then on May 31st, Ian Kennedy of UC Davis and Paul Gilman of Oak Ridge National Lab will introduce nanotechnology-based sensors for the detection of environmental contaminants. And then in the fall, the series is going to shift gears to discuss some of the human and environmental implications of nanotech. Are you back, Larry?
Mike, this is Larry Reed. I can hear that Larry has the speaker on the phone, and we should be able to get him to engage shortly. It'll just be another few seconds or so.
Okay.
One thing I would just like to add to folks, it's particularly good to hear Paul Gilman's going to be on the future call. I'm not sure if everyone at EPA remembers that Paul Gilman was the former Assistant Administrator for Research and Development until December.
Mike?
I'm here.
It's Elizabeth Freed. How are you?
Good.
Listen, when was the sensor call?
The sensor's call is going to be May 31st.
May 31st, thank you.
And each of those can be, they're going to be announced on EPA's TechDirect newsletter, and they can also be found on the NIEHS SBRP website and the CLUIN website for sign up.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Mike. This is Larry again. I apologize. I left a message. I have an alternate number.
Hello.
For Greg.
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you.
This is Greg Lowry.
Hi, Greg. We were expecting you.
Yeah, well, I actually had you all on speakerphone, but for some reason my phone wasn't calling in, so I redialed, and here I am now.
Okay, great. Perfect timing. Mike Gill just got through introducing you, so you can launch straight into your presentation.
Okay, good. I have an echo on this phone right now, so it's a little...
Yes, we have had a bit of a problem with the echoes today. We're not sure exactly what the problem is. If at all possible, if you can pick up your handset, it may help.
Yeah, I got the handset, but that's okay. All right, let's move
and
forward.
The echoes are not near as bad from you as they are from me, so you can go right ahead.
Okay. Well, welcome, everybody. Sorry about that technical problem. I'm going to talk a little bit today about the work we've been doing, developing functionalized reactive NDVI particles and some of the work in terms of the reactivity and the mobility. So if you go to slide 35, this is really a collaborative effort between a number of faculty at CMU. I've got a chemical engineer who looks at interfacial phenomena. I've got a chemist who develops all the polymers, and we sort of put them all together and apply them in for DNAP remediation. So a number of postdocs and students have been working on this, and I'm going to summarize about 5 years of work today. So if you go to slide 36, just to get everyone on the same page, the idea of DNAP treatment with an in-situ method is that if you look at the left picture there, what you have is a DNAP that spills. It's an oil phase. It has low solubility. As the water moves past it, a little bit of it dissolves and results in these plumes down gradient. And if you consider, say, a well there, and you look at the right side graph, if you took no action for these source zones, what you end up with would be sort of a steady state concentration in that well. And the idea with the NDVI injection is you'll put it in, you'll decrease some of the mass of the NAPL there, and that will result in a reduction of the downgradient flux. And hopefully you'll achieve some post-remedial level, either the MCL or some agreed-upon level. If you go to the next slide, 37. So the idea here of what we're doing is to take these nanoparticles and inject them into the ground. And they need to go find the NAPL and degrade it. And in order to do this effectively, you need a couple of parameters here. You need mobility of these particles. You'd really like target specificity. If you could have these particles go in and just react with the NAPL, then that would be ideal, but as I'll show you a little bit later, that's not really possible because it's non-specific reaction. You do want high reactivity of these particles, and ultimately you'd like a long lifetime if you could, but I'll show you a little bit later too that the geochemistry impacts the lifetime considerably. And then the fourth piece here, and Peter and Matt sort of alluded to this, is that since there is some uncertainty in the risks that these may pose to ecological receptors, you want to make sure that there's minimal potential risk or exposure to these nanoparticles once they've been injected. So if you go to slide 38, if you think about it, you're trying to optimize a couple different scenarios here. You have, at the injection point, a very high concentration of particles. You're trying to maximize their mobility to get them to go somewhere to deliver them. And you got to deliver enough material to optimize the remedial performance. And then as the particles move out away from the well, they're gonna disperse and they'll dilute and you end up with very low concentrations of particles. And you want to make sure that those don't go too far. So you want to minimize those risks. It's a little bit of a double-edged sword because you want to maximize mobility but also minimize mobility. But I think there's ways of handling that and I'll show you that. So if you go to slide 39, this gives you an idea of the materials. So the upper left corner there shows the RNIP material. We focus mainly on RNIP. We have looked at the borohydride reduced material, but the later stuff we've been doing is focused on RNIP, mostly because TOTA has been very good at just supplying us particles whenever we need them. And it's a pretty consistent product for us to work with. So you basically, simply, you take those particles, you add them to some of these surface modifiers, things like polystyrene sulfonate homopolymer, polyaspartic acid, which is a biopolymer, which is attractive because it's biodegradable and won't pose any ecotox risk. We're also looking at triblock copolymers, and I'll talk a little bit about why we're using those towards the end here, because we use them to target DNAPL and take the particles to the NAPL water interface. But once you take that iron and you put the coatings on the outside, you end up with this particle, sort of the bottom right-hand corner of slide 39 there. It's schematic, clearly, but you have a particle with an extended layer of a polymer, and that results in fairly stable suspensions of these materials in the scintillation vial there. And if you look at that table there, basically the surface modifiers, the triblock copolymer, SDBS, mRNIP, which is really a polyaspartate, what happens when you put the surface modifiers on is you increase the surface charge of those particles. And all the particles we were working with when you characterize them with DLS range in the tens, 20s of nanometers up to several hundred nanometers. So you go to slide 40. This is an outline of what I'm going to talk about today. The first piece is actually getting the particles to the DNAPL, and I think this is a critical component to in-situ remediation with these materials. It has to have some mobility, and there's a number of processes that are affecting that mobility. Things like aggregation, attachment to surfaces, which is essentially a filtration mechanism, and I'm going to talk a bit about how the coatings are used to minimize that. And then I'll move into the actual degradation rates of DNAPL. The reactivity and the lifetime issues, principally the effect of groundwater geochemistry and the surface coatings on that reactivity, and the fate of the particles and the coatings, which is clearly of importance given the uncertainty about the ecological risks or potential ecological risks. And then finally, I'll look at the DNAPL targeting issues that we've been working on and really outline a couple of approaches for in-situ targeting. So moving to slide 41, if you consider a nanomaterial porosity in porous media, nanomaterial mobility in porous media, there's a number of processes that can affect their mobility. And this is aggregation, shown in A there, which is basically the particles coming together to form larger agglomerates. Peter and Matt talked about that. If they get large enough, they can physically strain, as shown in B there. And then a critical factor is the attachment to the surfaces, shown in C. The particles basically adhere to sand grains or clay particles or what have you. And all of those things are limiting the mobility of these particles in porous medium. What you'd like to promote, if you could, is shown in D, which is the particles attaching to the entrapped NAPL. So really what you want to do is minimize the processes A, B, and C, so you get maximum mobility, but maximize the NAPL water interfacial targeting to try and get the materials right where the NAPL actually is. And there's a number of factors affecting the mobility, and I sort of put them into two categories. There's chemical factors, things like pH, ionic strength, the surface chemistry of the particles or the surface coatings on those particles. And then there's a bunch of physical factors, things like flow velocity, the particle aggregation and the size of those aggregates, and of course heterogeneity in real systems is going to play a big role here. And you have to consider all of these systematically to really understand how these things move through porous media. So moving to slide 42, excuse me, let's look at nanoparticle aggregation. We know that nanoparticles aggregate in water, for sure. They do this. There's high van der Waals attractive forces between the particles. Some particles may chemically bind or bond to one another. There's hydrophobicity that drives aggregation. Think about fullerenes. They're very hydrophobic. They aggregate in water to essentially minimize their contact with water. And what we've shown recently is that the magnetic attractive forces between particles, and especially NZVI, because Fe0 is very magnetic, that's causing rapid aggregation of those particles. And if you really step back and you look at nanoparticles in general, the fact that they're nano gives them very high diffusion coefficients. And that leads to many particle collisions, and that's why you get pretty rapid aggregation of these particles. But there are ways to stabilize them, and that's what the surface coatings do. So one of the first things we did was sort of look at the actual aggregation of just bare NZVI. There's no surface coatings on these. And if you look at the plot there, there's a couple things that show up. First of all, what this plot is showing you is the hydrodynamic radius of the particles, if you multiply by 2, that would be the diameter, versus time. So we put these particles into a system, and then we track them with DLS over time. And what you'll see, at about only 60 milligrams per liter, which is a pretty low concentration, much lower than the 10 grams per liter that you would actually inject. But what's happening to those particles is they're aggregating over time, and they're coming up to about a micron in size. At some point, they reach a critical aggregation. They start to form larger fractal aggregates. They gel. That's a term from ferrofluids. And a couple things to look at, too. The RNIP at 60 milligrams per liter, which is the upper plot there, compared to RNIP at 2 milligrams per liter, which are the closed circles at the bottom, you get different aggregate sizes. So particle concentration makes a big difference here. The other piece to look at, if you look at the line for RNIP and magnetite and hematite, those are all at very similar particle concentrations, and because their sizes are very, very similar. But what you see is that the RNIP aggregates rapidly, magnetite aggregates a little better or a little more than the hematite, and that trends with their magnetic susceptibility or saturation magnetization. So in the bottom there, the RNIP is greater than the magnetite, is greater than the hematite. So there's a number of factors that are going to affect the aggregation of these materials. Moving on to 43, we actually visualized this. I had a student, and he put about 80 milligrams per liter of RNIP into a slide or a cuvette. It loads up into a microscope, so we can actually look at it and take pictures of it. After just a minute, what you'll see in that figure is something about 5 micron-sized aggregates. After 9 minutes, you're getting doublets and triplets of those, and after 35 minutes, you're getting these large fractal aggregates. And we spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to actually measure the size of those fractal aggregates because the concentrations there are too great for DLS. But with the technique that we put together, the fractal aggregates actually turn out to be about 40 up to 140 microns in diameter, depending on the concentration. And if you look at the plot, plot on the right-hand side of this thing, what it's showing is the amount of particles that remain suspended in solution versus time. And you have these curves, and the upper part of those curves is when things are aggregating and sedimentation is relatively slow. Then you reach this gelation point where the particles get rather large and start to drop out of solution or sediment out. And this behavior is going to drastically affect how they behave in the groundwater, but also how they behave in natural waters or elsewhere. Moving on to 45. So the aggregation we looked at, the next thing we looked at was the attachment to surfaces. And attachment, it turns out, for nanomaterials in the environment is a very important fate process. It really is the reason that there's limited mobility of these materials in porous media. But if you consider attachment to surfaces, you might actually be limiting bioavailability or the ability to transform or degrade those materials, because things that are adhered to surfaces might not be bioavailable relative to ones that are floating around freely. So the attachment is going to be clearly a function of particle type based on the Hamilton constants or van der Waals forces, but more importantly, the types of coatings that are on these particles. And there's very large differences between nanoparticle types and especially the coatings on them. So moving to slide 46, just to illustrate how important the attachment to surfaces are, what we did was we used a PDMS cell, which is essentially a microscope slide that we dig out, and we can put a monolayer of sand in. And then we can run particles through that sand layer. And with the microscope, you can visualize the sand grains. So over on the right-hand side, what you see there is a sand grain. And at the tip of that sand grain, some of this nano iron is attaching to the surface there. And then over time, you know, 10 minutes later, what's happening is that material or that particle is getting bigger, because the nano iron is actually attaching to the particles that are there rather than to new spots on the sand grain. So it has some implications in terms of what type of models you might use to model the filtration processes. You know, clean bed filtration models may not be appropriate, especially at high concentrations, because what you have is more of a filter ripening type of effect here. But most importantly here, this clearly showed us that attachment to surfaces is what's limiting the mobility of these particles. So going to 47, this led us to start putting surface modifiers on these particles. And most commercial nanoiron available now has surface coatings on it. They realize that you can't make it mobile without putting a coating on there. And the coating part of this thing is rather proprietary. So it's hard to know what they're using and how it may perform. But there are a number of common surface coatings. Now, we're using TriBlock copolymers, which aren't as common, but a polymer in itself is a very common coating. Things like polyaspartic acid or polyaspartate, the biopolymer. People are using cellulose or carboxymethyl cellulose. Polyethylene glycol is very commonly used. Surfactants, things like SDBS, are also commonly used. What are these things actually doing to stabilize the particles? If you look at the bottom left there, there's two modes of stabilization that the coatings can afford. The first is an electrostatic stabilization or charge stabilization. You basically charge up the particles. Like charges don't like to be near each other, so they repel from one another. The other piece you have, is steric stabilization. So you put enough gunk on these particles, they basically can't get close enough to one another to actually aggregate. So the van der Waals attractive forces operate at very small distances, and you never reach that distance. So you end up having a repulsive force. And these coatings also, not only inhibiting aggregation, but they also inhibit the particle-media interactions, so they don't allow them to stick to the sand grains. So moving on to slide 48, we investigated several different modifiers, and there was a purpose behind this. Surfactants were the low end. They're low molecular weight. They do charge up the surface, but they don't have the size to provide the steric repulsions. And then as you move up the chain, the polyaspartic acid or polyaspartate has molecular weights of around 3 to 10,000. The polystyrene sulfonate, which is a homopolymer, has molecular weights about 70,000. And then our TriBlock copolymers are sort of the big ones. They have 125,000 molecular weight, and they're also highly charged. So they actually provide what we call electrosteric repulsions, which is both the charge and the steric. So there's some rhyme or reason, and everything we've done compares these different modifiers, and we can look at what properties of modifiers are going to matter in terms of enhancing mobility. So if you move to 49, this just shows the amount of particles that remain suspended in solution versus time. And we do this with UV-Vis. And the bare particles shown at the bottom have no polymer or no surface coatings. They rapidly aggregate, and pretty much all of it's fallen out. The minute you put any sort of surface coating on, whether it's SDBS or polyaspartate, which is denoted MRNIP there, or the triblock copolymer, what you basically see here is that some fraction of these particles are stabilized. You can't stabilize all of them, because some of them in this totem material, the RNIP, are just too large than to stabilize even with these polymers. But a good fraction is stabilized with the material. Moving on to slide 50. So we know the coatings can inhibit aggregation, but we wanted to really probe whether or not the coatings could inhibit sticking to surfaces. And one way to do this is to use something called the quartz crystal microbalance, which is, in essence, a silica surface, and you have an impinging flow on that surface, and particles that stick to it will change the residence frequency. So if you look at that plot there, bare RNIP is changing the residence frequency considerably, which indicates that a lot of things are sticking to it. So the bare particles are sticking to sand, which is consistent with our microfluidic cells. SDBS decreases the amount that sticks, but you still get some attachment. MRNIP's a little better, and the polymer modified material is a little better. In fact, the polymer modified material showed no attachment to the silica surface at all. And it turns out that aggregation or the ability to keep particles aggregated or from aggregating doesn't really track well with how they move through a sand column. And the QCM is a much better predictor, which is why we postulate that the attachment to surfaces is really controlling the mobility as opposed to the aggregation of these materials. All right, so moving on to 51. What we basically did is we coated a bunch of particles with different things, either our triblock copolymers or MRNIP, which is the polyaspartate, or FDBS, ran them through some sand columns, and just looked at how much came out. And looking at that plot, the bare RNIP, almost nothing comes through the column. This stuff aggregates. It's very consistent with the PDMS microfluidic cell. And I think there's been some field trials where this has been injected in the bare material, and they've also shown that it just doesn't go anywhere, which makes sense given the properties of those materials. The minute you put any sort of coating on, it enhances mobility. And there's variability between the types of coatings that are used. So the triblock copolymers and the MRNIP or the polyaspartate are doing a very good job, and essentially 100% of the material is coming through. The surfactant doesn't do quite as good of a job. But what's nice about the fact that different modifiers give you different mobilities is that we may be able to match a modifier with the geochemistry of the site to predict how far it will go, or in essence select how far it would go. It gives you some control over placement of these materials. Of course, we haven't done that in the field yet, but we're moving in that direction. Excuse me. All right. So those experiments were done at very low ionic strength. And we all know from college science, and Peter and Matt described this, that the ionic strength and the ionic composition is going to play a big role, and mostly in compressing the electric double layer. And you lose, at ionic strength, you lose the electrostatic repulsions. And unfortunately, most people that have been working with this material and looking at how the mobility of these particles is increased with coatings are all doing this at very, very low ionic strength that may or may not be representative of what you'd find in the field. So we did a very controlled study, a systematic study, looking at how the different ions, things like sodium or calcium, affect the mobility of the materials. And what you do here is essentially look at the breakthrough curves of a pulse of particles as a function of ionic strength. And what you'll see in the upper there for the sodium is that as you increase the ionic strength, the mobility of these particles goes down. And for calcium, the same thing occurs, but at much lower concentrations because calcium does a better job at shielding charge. So we'll go into the next slide. From a number of these studies at different ionic strengths and with different polymers, what you can get out of this is basically a transport distance or a sticking coefficient alpha, which then you can use to predict the transport distance. And this is somewhat arbitrary in that we have selected the distance to be that which 99% of the particles would be removed. So only, 99% of the particles are going to stop or only go this distance. And there's a couple things to note in this plot. First of all, looking at the bottom there, this is some site groundwater, some different sites we've been playing with, and you can see that the ionic strength varies considerably. Alameda Point is a marine site, and the ionic strengths are quite high. There's a lot of calcium and magnesium in this water, several millimolar. Parris Island, South Carolina, has much lower monovalent cations, sort of in this 1 to 10 millimolar range. But it also has calcium and magnesium. And since we know calcium and magnesium is much more efficient at shielding charge, and it's much more efficient at mitigating the transport of these particles, it's the one that's really going to control the mobility at these sites. So if you look at the red ones in that table, the upper table there, calcium concentrations of 1 or 0.5 millimolar for polyaspartate or SDBS result in transport distances of, several meters at 0.5 millimolar to about 1 meter, maybe 2 meters at 1 millimolar. And again, this is the distance it would take to remove 99% of these particles in this nice sand column that we're using. So, and mobilities are not going to be all that great, and they're going to be controlled by calcium and magnesium. The tri-block copolymer, because it's so large, it provides this electrosteric repulsions, and because it has the steric side of this, the transport distances are going to be farther. But even then, you're only looking at 25 meters or so at 5 millimolar. At 0.5 millimolar, the column we were using was too short. It, in essence, all moved. So if you're going to use these things in real groundwaters, especially ones that have calcium and magnesium around, you're going to need fairly large molecular weight polymers to make this work, or to get transport distances that are large, tens of meters perhaps. Otherwise, don't expect them to go too far. But, if you know where the source is, you might be able to inject and have it go only a few meters, and that would be fine. Plus, it mitigates any concerns about runaway particles or these particles transporting too far. So moving to slide 54, I need to emphasize, though, that, this is a sand column that we did this in. And we can do that to predict distances in sand columns under the conditions that we evaluated. But unfortunately, real sites are not sand columns. And there's a variety of scales here, from the column studies up to 2D cells or intermediate scale. And then ultimately, the field scale has heterogeneity. And you can't necessarily use what we've predicted there in distances and go out in the field and say, oh, it's going to go 2 meters. We're working actually with a CERTIF project right now to try and upscale this process. Take the parameters that we measure or learn in the column studies and 2D cells and try to see how they upscale and predict them in the field. I'll talk more about that at the end here in a little bit. So moving on to 55, another component of this is clearly the reactivity issue. And there's several fundamental questions that you'd want to ask yourself. You need to know what the rates of reaction are and what the products are. You want to know how long those particles remain active, because that basically dictates when you might go back and re-inject if you need to or not. It also dictates how quickly the NAPL would go away. You want to understand what geochemical factors are affecting the reactivity and lifetime. Most studies, even ours, are done in the lab, in DI water, to really understand what's going on. But in the field, you're going to have dissolved solutes, you're going to have organic carbon, you're going to have varying pHs, and you got to understand how that affects the lifetime of the particles. And then, of course, we know that we're going to have to modify the surfaces of these particles, and we want to know how those surface modifiers affect reactivity. So I'm going to talk about all of those pieces here. Moving on to 56. Looking at a reactive nanoparticle, this is the TOTA material in the upper right there. They really are a core shell material with an iron zero core and a magnetite shell. And that iron zero core is oxidizing, and hopefully it's reducing your contaminant, TCE, to either acetylene or ethene or ethane. And I'll show you some of those products in a minute. But it's also reducing H+ to make hydrogen gas, because the potentials are low enough here to basically generate hydrogen. And you have to consider that in the lifetime calculations and in the calculations of how much iron it takes to reduce your contaminant, because some of it's going to be oxidized by other species. And you'd expect the lifetime to depend on both the oxidant loading, either TCE or whatever contaminant you're after, but also the pH of the system. So moving on to 57. We looked at several different types of iron, and the reason I throw this in here is because a lot of people think of nano iron as nano iron, but it's really not all the same. In fact, they're very, very different. So there's two main ones. There's borohydride reduced iron, which there's a lot of publications about this iron. It's fairly simple to make in your lab. You take iron, add some sodium borohydride, precipitate out iron zero. The other process is a gas phase reduction. It's a commercial process. Take a starting material like ferrous sulfate, oxidize it to the oxyhydroxide, reduce that with gas phase hydrogen to iron zero, bleed in a little bit of water, which basically gives you this magnetite shell and the iron zero core. And that's the material the TOTA is. So they're both nano irons. They both look similar under with TEM, which, I didn't have that. I didn't put that slide in. So both of them look very, very similar under TEM, but their physical and chemical properties are quite different. And their reactivity is quite different as well. So going to 58, if you look at the differences in reactivity, now this is reactivity with TCE rather than carbon tetrachloride. If you look at the left one, TCE is going down. This is the borohydride material. TCE is reduced fairly rapidly, and you're getting primarily ethane and ethene, or these saturated products. You also get some C4 to C6 coupling products that are fully saturated as well. Half-life time, somewhere around 2 hours at a 2 gram per liter concentration. If you look at the arnet material on the right-hand side there, TCE disappears a little bit slower, and you're forming predominantly unsaturated products. And in fact, you're generating a lot of acetylene, which can then go on and react to form ethene. But clearly, you have different pathways here. And you've got to keep in mind that it only takes 4 electrons to get to acetylene, which is a dechlorinated, non-toxic product, versus 8 to get to ethane. So there's some implications in terms of the efficiency of these materials. If you look at the half-life of arnet, it's somewhere around 8 hours at 2 grams per liter. So, a factor of 4 difference. So moving on to 59, it's important to understand what the lifetime of this material is. And again, since H+ can oxidize the iron to form hydrogen, you have to consider that reaction, and that's going to strongly depend on pH, obviously, or at least it should. And if you look at the plot here at the bottom left, which shows the hydrogen production, but it's presented as the percent of iron zero in the particle. So as it gets to 100, essentially all the iron zero has been used. And it's, so it's showing that versus time for several different pHs. So in the lab, when this iron corrodes, it's usually corroding at 8 to 9 pH, because that's what you get in the lab. And you get lifetimes that are about 9 months. You can predict that given the rate. It's pretty good. You could eject this in the ground, it would stay there for a considerable amount of time. But in reality, when you inject this into the ground with some buffer capacity of the aquifer material and maybe the groundwater, you might be corroding it more near neutral. And when you bring the pH down to 7 or 6, your lifetime suddenly become only a few weeks. So the amount of time that this iron is going to last in the ground is really strongly dependent on the geochemistry of the site. And you've got to take that into consideration. So going to the next slide, which is 60, I don't see, for some reason, oh, there it is. Okay. So
one of the hypotheses you have about these particles is that since they're core shell, if you look in the upper right of the figure there, as the iron zero is oxidizing and the magnetite shell is forming, you're in essence going to get a thicker magnetite shell. And you could hypothesize that that might slow the rate of reaction down because you get some mass transfer resistance to electrons across that barrier. But we basically took some particles and put them into a little reactor shown there on the right, and we measured the reactivity with TCE at different time points during the lifetime of that particle. And the particle iron content reduced from about 48% initially down to 22%. So it is aging over this time. And the observed rate constant actually did not change very much. There was some initial reduction that's transient and has to do with the fact that the particles were dry before we put them in. But over the life of the particle after the first 10 days or so, you got a fairly stable rate constant. In fact, it increased a little bit over time, but that was due to the slight decrease in pH. So it's kind of nice. I mean, the implications of that, so you inject this material, and the reactivity is going to remain fairly constant over the life of the particle. So it helps you to plan what rate the NAPL should be reacting at. Going on to the next slide, which is 61. You may want to consider using this in a source zone. In fact, I think the advantage of the NZVI is the fact that you can deliver it directly to the source. If you have a deep source, it might be the only viable option, really. So what we did was we looked at the rate constant, the reaction of TCE, as a function of the TCE concentration solution. The bottom there, 0.027 millimolar TCE, represents a plume, although it's still a pretty high concentration plume. And the top represents essentially the case where you had NAPL present. And what you can see is the slope of those lines aren't changing considerably, which tells you that the rate constant is not changing a whole lot, which is kind of nice. There's a very small effect. In fact, at most, it's a factor of 2. So a small effect of the TCE concentration on the reactivity. But what's interesting, and if you look at the right-hand plot, you have hydrogen evolution as a function of time in the same exact systems. And when you apply this at a low concentration, like 0.027 or 0.11, you're reacting TCE, but you're also evolving hydrogen. So the hydrogen that's being evolved accounts for somewhere around 50% of the particles, or the iron zero in the particles. As you increase the TCE concentration, then the TCE is suddenly out-competing H-plus for the electrons from the iron, and you're using a lot more of your iron to convert TCE, so you get a lot less hydrogen production. So basically what comes out of this is that it looks advantageous to use this in a source area rather than in a plume. Moving on to 62, we started playing around with trying to understand how the different dissolved species might affect the reactivity. So if you look at the upper left plot there, this is the reactivity, the log of TCE versus time, the slope of which gives you the rate. DI water is clearly the fastest. You put anything in solution, whether it's chloride, sulfate, bicarbonate, phosphate, it slows the reaction, and the effect is somewhere between 2 and 7, depending on which solute you're using. And it looks like these are following the trend with how well these things might complex with HFO. Now, granted, our surfaces aren't HFO, but we hypothesize here that essentially these species are adsorbing to the surface and interfering with the reaction that way. What's interesting, if you look at the bottom right, is under those same conditions with those same dissolved solutes, they're not having any effect at all on the hydrogen evolution. So the dissolved solutes seem to affect the reactivity of TCE, but not the reactivity with H+. We still don't understand why that might be. But it might imply two different sites for a reaction. If we could figure that out, we could optimize iron to have the site to react TCE, but to not have the site to react the H+, that's about a 10-year project. I'll be back with you in a decade on that one. The other thing to consider is how the modifiers are affecting the reactivity. So essentially what we looked at, what this plot shows is the reactivity with TCE for bare material compared to the reactivity with tri-block copolymer modified material or the surfactant SDBS. And what you can see here is that you actually have up to an order of magnitude decrease in reactivity. And this makes sense. You're putting something on the surface. It's a surface-mediated reaction. You're blocking access to the surface. You should be slowing down the reaction. There's some correlation with the size of the polymer, but we're still trying to work that out. I think the interesting thing here, though, is even if you look at the slowest reactivity, the one with, in the top there, the RNIT plus PSS650, which is our largest tri-block copolymer, the half-life time for TCE would be on the order of 6 days at 2 grams per liter. And the reason I keep using 2 grams per liter is because that's sort of the recommended or the target application concentration. It's what you'd be shooting for when you're injecting it from the ground. So is 6 days fast enough? I don't think we really know that. There's a lot of factors in terms of the mass transfer rate, the dissolution of the NAPL. We really just don't know. I have a sort of project to look at that now, but it's unclear whether that's going to be fast enough. But if you compare it to other alternatives, the 6 day half-life time is pretty good. Moving on to 64, sort of the last piece here is this idea of contaminant source zone targeting. If you think about a NAPL source, it's one piece of a larger context of a whole field system. And the idea, if you inject any particles, they're going to move through the porous media and hopefully find this source somehow. If they go around the source, then maybe they're not doing any good for you. So what we're trying to do is find ways that we can take these particles, modify their surfaces such that they will be attracted to the NAPL water interface and stay there. You can sort of think of this as a particle that's smart enough to go hunt out and seek what it's looking for. And if we could pull this off, I think this would be very helpful for the application. Going to slide 65, there's a number of ways to do this. And the first is interfacial targeting, and that's what we kind of started with. And that's where these tri-block copolymers come into play. If you look at the upper right corner there, the tri-block copolymer has three different pieces. The first piece is a polyacrylic acid, and it's a carboxylic acid group, and it binds strongly to the iron surface, and that was sort of our anchor block. And the middle block there is a polymethylmethacrylate, which is a hydrophobic block, and the idea was to give it some affinity for NAPL. And then the final block, the one in pink there, is a hydrophilic block. You have to have that to make these particles water-soluble so they'll move, and that's the polystyrene sulfonate. And the idea, you know, following that arrow there, is that when this particle gets to an oil-water interface or a solvent-water interface, the polymethylmethacrylate block is going to swell in the solvent and the PSS will shrink. And conversely, in the water, the PSS will swell and the polymethylmethacrylate will shrink. And it basically gives these particles a thermodynamic affinity for that NAPL water interface. And it actually worked. We took these particles, we modified them, and we added them with TCE and sonicated. And what happens, and what's shown in the picture there on the bottom left, is that these particles are emulsifying TCE. And what you see there are TCE droplets in water being stabilized by these nanoiron particles. And sort of at the very bottom left is a close-up of these particles. So there is potential to deliver these things to the NAPL water interface. Moving on to 66. There are some real challenges, though. I mean, the chemistry is working in our favor. We have this coating now that can put things at the NAPL water interface. But can you still hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, good. The echo went away in my phone, so I thought maybe I was cut off. All right, so we have these particles now that can go to the NAPL water interface. So we have the chemistry working for us. But you got to think about the physics. I mean, this is porous media. These particles are moving through the porous media, and what's shown here is a microfluidic cell, and the large gray circles are silica, essentially, and that's those represent the grains, and then the spaces in between represent the pores. And what we have is TCE on one side and water on the other side. And the TCE is sort of the, well, it's hard to see, but they're labeled there. And the particles are flowing through the water. And what you're seeing there in those lines are the trajectories of those particles at different flow velocities, ranging from 2.6 up to 13 meters per day, which you could argue is pretty fast. But even at the slowest velocities, the particles just aren't getting to the interface. They're flowing past that interface. So we have some work to do to encourage the mixing or to better understand how we can actually get the particles to that interface. We're not giving up on this, but we're going to have to be smart about how we get those particles to the interface in real systems, in real porous media. So moving on to 67, there's another way to maybe target. And that way is essentially creating a particle. And you know the particles aren't mobile unless you have this surface coating on them. So if you created a particle where the surface coating actually came off, either in the presence of NAPL or at some specified time, you could just use that to deliver the particle. The coating comes off. Maybe you could even have a coating that would stimulate microbial growth or something. But if the coating comes off, it leaves behind the particle. So what we did was we looked at all these coatings, polyaspartic acid and the polystyrene sulfonate and carboxymethyl cellulose, and we, in essence, looked at the rate of desorption of these coatings on the particles. And what's shown here is at 2 weeks, 4 weeks, and 8 weeks, this is representing the percent of the polymer coating that's still on the particles. And you can see after 8 weeks, most of it's still on the particles. So this idea of destabilization targeting, at least with these particular modifiers, probably isn't going to happen. But what it does show on the bright side is that one of the concerns of this process is you have these coatings, they're surfactants. If they go in and start to mobilize the NAPL, then maybe that's a bad thing. But it's looking like, with these particular polymers anyway, they're just not coming off the surface. So the concerns about NAPL mobilization due to the desorption of these coatings is probably not going to be a problem. So moving on to 68. There might be other strategies for controlled placement of the nanoiron. If you think about it, you have a well, you're injecting this material. As things move radially away from this well, the geochemical conditions are changing. So you have relatively low ionic strength water that you're injecting with. As it moves away from the well, it basically dilutes it at 1 over R, or it scales with R. You end up with a dilution, and you're diluting with groundwater that may have some calcium or magnesium in it or higher ionic strength, and we know that higher ionic strengths, the particles aren't very mobile. So there may be ways to tailor an injection scheme such that the particles will be mobile and then get to a certain point and stop. And, of course, there's also velocity variations from being very rapid where you inject to background conditions away from the well, and we're exploring whether or not we can use that velocity variation to help target particles. And another potential way to go is looking at the saturation of NAPL. If you think about NAPL pools, it's very saturated at the pool surface out to partial saturation, and there might be ways to utilize that with some hydrodynamic trapping or potentially co-solvency effects where we have a coating that responds to the NAPL, and when the NAPL is there at low saturation, that's enough to make those coatings change form and leave the particles behind. So this is sort of the future. This won't be ready next year, but it's the kind of thing that we're working on to try and place these particles in a specific location. So moving on to 69, let me just conclude here. Aggregation and attachment definitely limits the bare nanoparticles and limits their mobility in aquifers. Surface modification definitely increases their mobility, but the calcium and magnesium in groundwater is going to control the mobility. We believe, at least with the polymer coatings that we've tested, tens of meters are possible as long as you're using the appropriate coatings. The iron is clearly highly reactive with TCE and continues to be even when you do it under environmental conditions. The lifetime of the particles depends heavily on the geochemistry, but also on the oxidant loading. So if you use it in a source zone, the lifetime was quite short because most of it's being reacted via the TCE. And clearly, based on this, use in NAPL source areas maximizes iron zero utilization, and I think source zones should be the target of these materials. plume remediation with these probably doesn't make a lot of sense. In-situ targeting of entrapment apple is going to require more optimization of the coatings, also some engineering methods to put them in the ground, but we think that matching the modifier type with the geochemistry type certainly offers some potential for controlled placement. Moving on to 70, I was asked to put something in here on the advantages of nano versus micro, because there's a lot of work right now and people are injecting microscale iron and people are injecting nanoscale iron. There's at least 30 trial sites that I know about. So I tried to put a couple of points together on the difference between nano and micro. So nano clearly has a greater surface area, you know, 15 to 30 square meters per gram versus 0.1 for the micro, which basically to get the same reactivity or reaction rates, you need to use a lot less material of the nano iron than the micro scale iron. I think the biggest advantage of the nano iron is that you can deliver it to the source fairly inexpensively with direct push wells, assuming that you have the right coatings. Putting in micro scale iron requires high pressure injection and tends to be higher cost to put in. If you think about the total cost of a project here, you know, you're going to have management and engineering of this to put it in, the injection services to mobilize and then demobilize, and materials costs. And at the pilot scale, at least, all the studies, materials are only about 15% of the total cost. So the injection services and managing these things is most of the cost. So if you have an injection scheme that requires this high cost, then your total cost is going to be greater. But, you know, I'm not advocating one versus the other here at all. I think both have their place under different conditions, and the market will sort of bear out which makes the most sense, I think. I'm just highlighting the advantages and disadvantages of each. So moving on to 71, I think what we need, even though there's been 30 field trials of this stuff, you know, most of them are companies, and companies don't want to pay. It's not a research project. They're trying to fix their problem. So there hasn't been a whole lot of understanding of what's really going on in the field. So we have to assess the effect of treatment on the NAPL mass and the mass emission from the source zone, and that's going to require extensive characterization before a test, during that test, and after that test. So I guess what I'm arguing for is sort of one experimental area where we have plenty of money to really characterize this thing and truly understand how it works and what's going on. Another piece that I think needs to be looked at in the near term is trying to understand how the NZVI and the microbial communities at a site interact. Clearly you're making a bunch of hydrogen, the microbes can use hydrogen, and there's going to be some synergy here. The NZVI is not forming chlorinated intermediates, but we know that the biological reduction does, and in many of the field sites we're seeing chlorinated intermediates, which tells me that the microbial communities are involved. The EZVI folks think that the microbial community is a good portion of what's going on in their particular system. So in the different surface coatings have the potential of acting as carbon sources for microbes. So there's a lot of room here to play with this and to sort of optimize this system. So moving on to 72, I just want to acknowledge, you know, we've been fortunate to have funding from everywhere, EPA, DOE, DOD, NSF. We've sort of hit up every agency that was willing to give us some money. And, of course, TOTA for always supplying us the materials. And with that, I would be happy to answer any questions if you might have them.
Thank you, Greg. Well, let me get back on the handset, see if we can keep the echo down. It did reduce a bit during the end of your presentation. I think someone may have disconnected who was causing an issue.
Yeah, no, it totally stopped.
Yeah, although I do still hear it with mine, so hopefully I'll keep my comments down. I'd just like to thank you and the other presenters, Matt Hull and Peter Vexelin, today. We'd like to move into the question and answer period, and we only have a few minutes today. We're running a little bit late. So let me check with the phone participants. If you would, please take your phone off mute, and you can ask a question, but please introduce yourself and name your organization. Okay, while we let our phone participants get their thoughts together, let me read a couple or a question that I have from an internet participant. This is from Leanne Ostrand, C
PH2M Hill in Gilbert, Arizona. Have you attempted to apply this material to the subsurface? If so, by what method, and are you selecting environments with controlled ionic strength, or are you adjusting the aquifer to the preferred ionic strength? Let me note also that the questions have been coming in constantly. Some of these may be for Matt and or Peter. It's a little hard for me to tell sometimes. So let me just check and see, do we still have Matt and Peter on the line with us?
Yes, we are both here.
Great. So, guys, I'm going to read the questions, and I will let y'all decide who is best to answer it, because I don't have a clear distinction of which questions are for which speakers. So let me repeat that one more time. I'm sorry. This is from Leanne Ostrens, CH2M Hill in Gilbert, Arizona. Have you attempted to apply this material to the subsurface? If so, by what method? And are you selecting environments with controlled ionic strength, or are you adjusting the aquifer to the preferred ionic strength?
Yeah, so I mean, I can answer that. I haven't personally done this yet. I'm just now getting involved with the Navy on trying to do this. But there have been over 30 sites where this has been applied. Most of the application, well, there's a variety of injection techniques, but I think the geoprobe and trying to do it at a low cost is predominantly the way it's done. As far as adjusting the ionic strength of an aquifer purposefully, I think that would sort of blow out the cost of this thing. So what I think the approach is going to be is to adjust the particles to match the ionic strength that's already existing there. You're going to affect the ionic strength to some degree, because you're injecting fresh water, although there is an issue with where you get that water, and some people actually take site water and do the injection with site water, in which case they're not affecting the geochemistry at all.
Thank you. Perhaps this follows on to that question. This is from Philippe Glasson, University of Quebec at Montreal in Canada. Where does the hydrogen come from in the reaction? From water or organic matter degradation?
Well, in our studies, it comes from water, basically. It's the H-plus floating around in the water that's being reduced, and you form hydrogen and OH-minus. Most of ours, we're not adding organic carbon.
Okay, let's check with our phone participants. If anyone has a question, you can take your phone off mute, and please introduce yourself and name your organization. Okay, I have another set of questions from Jim Wolf, Tetra Tech EM in Denver. First question is, has nanoscale ZBI been tried at any high sulfate sites? Parenthetically, sulfate over 1,000 milligrams per liter. Second question is, do you think the effect of sulfate on reactivity of TCE versus reactivity of hydrogen precludes the use of nanoscale ZBI in a high sulfate environment?
Well, so sulfate's an interesting one. Sulfate by itself isn't really having a big effect. I think there have been some trials of this in marine sites where sulfates are quite high, but I don't know the specifics of those. What I can say about sulfate and what's going to happen is you're going to get microbial, you're going to get sulfate reduction, because you're basically creating reducing conditions in an aquifer that with those sulfate levels are going to promote sulfate reduction by microorganisms. And how that's affecting the process, I don't know. You're making a bunch of sulfide and you're making a bunch of iron sulfide, and it's possible you're passivating the surfaces. Just don't have the answers to that right now.
Okay, let's check back with our phone participants. You can take your phone off mute. Please introduce yourself and name your organization. Okay, I'm trying to leave them enough time to ask a question. Let me continue on and read one more that we have from an internet participant. This is, they only identify themselves as CRA, and that may be a name or an organization, I'm not sure, but it's in Niagara Falls, New York. Question is, what are the kinetics of carbon tetrachloride transport to the encapsulated particle?
That's not something that we've investigated at this point, but what we are, I probably didn't make this clear in the presentation, but the concept here is to actually have the capsule degrade and release the iron once it's at the point of where the target is located. So the concept there would be to have the either the contaminant or some external conditions that we are capable of manipulating actually help facilitate the direct the breakdown of that capsule and then the direct interaction of the iron with the contaminant.
Okay, let me take a break for just a second and note I've got about 4:35, so we're running just a bit over our scheduled time. So I'd like to stop just briefly and thank our speakers today one more time. I'd like to call the audience's attention to the feedback form. You can find a link to that on the seminar webpage. Also, you can find a link to the additional resources. So I would like to go ahead and end the seminar, but I would like to check back with our phone participants one more time real quickly just to see if I jogged someone's memory to ask another question. So you can take your phone off mute and please introduce yourself and your organization. Okay, I think we've given them enough opportunity. And we got through the vast majority of the questions from the internet participants. I do have a few more that I'll forward to you guys by email. Let's just note one last time, you can continue to submit questions, and we will get them answered by email. We mentioned one last time, the nanotechnology seminar series continues most of the year in 2007. We have sessions scheduled in April on the 19th, in May on the 31st, and then we'll pick back up again in the fall with some related seminars. With that, I'd like to sign off and offer final thanks to today's speakers, Matt Hull, Peter Weixland, Greg Lowry, and I'd also like to thank Mike Gill, who joined us from EPA Region 9 to co-moderate. Thanks to everyone, and we hope to see or hear all of you next month as well. Thank you.